You're listening to No Plot, Only Lore, a podcast about games and the tables we play them at. Your DMs tonight and every night are Josh and Chris. You can find us on all podcast platforms or check us out at noplotonlylore.com. If you like what you hear today, please rate and review the show and share it with everyone you've ever met.
All right, welcome back to No Plot, Only Lore, our favorite D&D podcast. And this week I went and saw Dune.
I saw Dune as well. I screamed at you for 3 days to not say anything about Dune 2 before I could go see it myself.
I like to be clear, the only thing that I said about Dune 2 was Dune is good.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about armor.
That's too close to a spoiler.
So Dune 2 was good.
Yeah, Dune 2 was excellent.
Everyone should go and watch it.
Dune 2, Dunes.
Two Dunes. And the armor in Dune is really cool.
Yeah. There's several good designs of armor that makes sense.
Well, and like I loved the armor from the first movie, too.
Yep.
And I actually remember posting a Facebook post about the Sardaukar armor.
Yeah.
When I first saw it, because I was so stoked about how, one, medieval it looked.
True.
Like, it's very obviously a spacesuit.
Yes.
But it looks like a medieval spacesuit.
Yeah, it's got pauldrons and...
Yeah. Yeah, and like plates and things. And it looks like if you took an astronaut and turned that astronaut into a knight.
Yeah.
That's what he would look like. Right. And I thought that was just absolutely brilliant design. But it's not the only design. Like you were talking about how cool the Atreides armor was.
Oh, the Atreides armor is just like straight up plate. Like this is an odd description, but like in every fantasy game that has like elemental based armor, this would be like what the earth elemental people kind of wore. Like,
yeah,
bulky, big, broad, flat plates that like overlap and then rise almost like a mountain up towards the throat. Like, and all of these parts are functional. Like, hey, did you know that you need a gorget if you're going to be fighting people with swords? Because your neck is super vulnerable?
Well, and like the height of the gorget on the Sardaukar armor was great too, because like it leads into the like big astronaut helmet and lends itself to that that look of medieval. The thing that I liked about the Atreides armor was the texture on it.
Yeah.
Right? Like it looked like stone.
Like
they were just wearing slabs of stone, but all of it moved well.
Right.
Right. Like the chest pieces made sense as chest pieces. There were like segmented pieces along the torso for like ease of movement in the belly. Right. Like there was cloth in like areas where you would expect to see cloth for like under the arms. And like under pauldrons and stuff. But then they also had the pauldrons that overlaid it. It's just so fucking cool.
Well, and the other thing that all of the different armors did well, from the Harkonnen, Atreides, the Sardaukar armor, they all communicated something about the people that were wearing them and like the things that they valued. So like the Atreides armor really reminds you of their like their stoicism and their like their
practicality.
Yeah, their practicality, their reliability, like the things that like stone evokes in you, you know. The Harkonnen armor very much reminds you of like these guys are tied to space and moving around a lot, and they're also like
we got to mention that absolutely goofy sand armor.
Right.
The Harvester, because that helmet was goofy.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, the Harkonnen armor in the first movie, like,
yeah,
big bulky shoulders and gorgets, and then like flowy robes below, but like the juxtaposition between the all black armor and then their like white bald heads just like communicates this the weirdness that they have. But then they
wore it so well too.
Oh yeah. And then they go and they put these stupid hats on them every time they go out in the sand. And it's like you took away everything cool about the kit.
Just a giant Mysterio fishbowl helmet.
Well, you know, they had a good Mysterio one in the first movie. Just that, like, black bubble. And then they put this, like, dunce cap on them and sent them out to die in the sand.
Well, I think it got bigger in the second movie too, or just like in the first movie it looked sleek, and in the second movie it looked like one of those drinks that you get in Las Vegas that's like way too big and has too much going on.
Like an actual fishbowl, like the first one, it was rounded but it still had some angles to it. You know, but
some menace that didn't come from like just being alien.
Exactly.
And like, not to say that the sand armor didn't seem alien, it's just it seemed really top-heavy and kind of impractical.
Very impractical, yeah. Like it, to me, it looked like something where it was like, this is a survival kit, and then if you have to take it into combat, you're not in a great place because you have no peripheral vision.
But that got us thinking about gear.
Yeah. About
equipment. And like the ways that equipment can be used in your games to both enhance your games and your connections to your worlds and your characters, and also maybe detract from it sometime if you put a giant fishbowl on your character.
Yeah, I mean, you know, characters start with a certain level of gear that's very starter, but items and the equipment that you use can definitely help enhance the roleplay and the storytelling as you go. Too many people forget that, like, everything they have is a tool.
Well, and I think that there's a mentality similar to the one that we have when we're playing video games, where it's just your inventory.
Yeah, right? Like, yeah.
These aren't individual items. It's just the stuff I have.
Right.
The collection of stuff I have. But, like, the difference between good equipment and bad equipment can save your life.
Yeah,
like in a real world environment, right? Not to get too simulationist with it, but like if you're in a survival or travel scenario where you have to rely on this equipment for your safety and security, good equipment matters.
Well,
you need to have a good tent. You need to have a good backpack.
Yeah, and also like people forget with their characters that like you have. Like, you as a person have stuff. Like, it's my stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And not all of it is, like, practical or useful, but it's things you carry around for a variety of reasons that you know, especially if, like, you're living this semi-nomadic lifestyle that these characters would be, there are certain things you're still going to bring with you everywhere you go. Mm-hmm. Right?
And not all of that is going to have, like you said, a practical purpose, right? Like, how many people are running around with, like, photos in their wallet?
Yeah.
Right. Like, not a thing that you ever need for a practical purpose, but it's something that has sentimental value. And so you're carrying it around with you all the time.
Yeah.
And like, think about all the stuff that you have in your car, right? Like the items that you have in your car that don't necessarily have a practical purpose while you're driving from point A to point B. Right. And so I kind of wanted to go into that a little bit and talk about like, what is your gear about? And how do you make that gear matter more?
Definitely.
So, and I think the first thing for that is like really understanding two things. And that's what is your gear for? What does it do? Why do you have it? Mm-hmm. If you have it for a reason. And two, where did it come from?
Right.
Right. Because if you are a newly minted rogue graduating from Rogue University and you go to the Rogue store and you buy a Rogue kit, that is possibly the most boring way for you to get gear.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a very easy trap to fall into. I mean, like, you know, 5th edition, everyone starts out and it's like, okay, creating your character, did you take the adventurer's backpack or the climber's backpack? What's the difference? One gives you more rope, right?
I've never actually noticed that. How much rope does the climber's backpack give you?
Like, it just gives you rope. Like, the other one just doesn't have a rope.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, which is like, like, just speaking as like a slight survivalist nerd here, like, just have rope, like, all the time.
Yeah.
It's so needed.
Yeah.
But
the,
yeah.
The wonders that I have seen people do with, like, twine and a tarp is, like, crazy.
You've got your fire starter. You can catch animals with little homemade snares. Like, there's so many things. Anyways, the point is not to talk about rope. The point is that, like... Everyone just kind of looks at this default and it's like, oh, this is just like the stuff I need for my character to survive. Off we go. I have a bed and a water can and maybe have some rope and a candle.
Right. But like, if you have a candle,
right,
where did you get your candle from? Right. Like, if I was preparing to go on an adventure today and I needed a candle, I would probably not be stopping by the hardware store to pick up a bunch of candles. Right, I have candles. They're in my survival kit right now, right? Like, they're in my earthquake kit.
Yeah.
I would scavenge a couple of candles from there, and I would throw them in my backpack, and that's where they would be from. And
right.
Knowing that tells you a few things about me as a person. One, I live in a place where earthquakes happen.
Uh-huh.
And two, I am the type of person who is prepared enough to have an earthquake kit.
Yeah.
And three, I'm the type of person that's irresponsible enough to scavenge things from my earthquake kit.
Yeah, but like, also, like, what does a candle mean to you? Like, if I was grabbing candles for heading out, I have a bunch of tea lights I'd be grabbing. I'd probably grab a half dozen of them. Like, I don't have long stick taper candles, you know?
Which is where our candles would be different, right? Like, you would have a bunch of tea lights, and I would have, like, a stack of, like, beeswax long stick candles.
Yeah.
That are, like, waterproof.
Right? Yeah.
So, and, like, the difference in that is both illustrative of character and has, like, a practical application. Like, your tea lights will be better in some situations than my long stick candles will be.
Yeah, it'll be much easier for me to use them as, like, a big fire starter than... You know,
for sure.
Then you're a long one.
Or like if you need to float them across a thing. Right?
Yeah.
Like I can't float my candle, but you can float a tea light for sure.
Yeah.
So like I kind of put together, like I looked at every item from a rogues pack and I kind of tried to think about where I would have gotten those things.
Okay.
And so for the backpack holds stuff, right? It's the thing that you use to carry other things. And maybe yours belonged to a relative, right? It used to be your mom's for school, right? It used to be a book bag. Or maybe it was yours and it was your camping backpack.
Yeah, yeah.
Ball bearings. You're a rogue. You stole some shit from a hardware store.
Right? Yeah.
Like, you were just there, you pocketed a bunch of ball bearings, and now you've got those. String, right? Like, you bought it at a bodega. Right, not necessarily like a hardware store, not necessarily like an outfitter's, but like you were at a
corner store.
A corner store, and you realized you needed some string.
Yeah.
My earthquake kit has so much fucking string in it. Crowbar. I put on the crowbar that you found on your way home, because there was actually a machete that I found on the road.
Huh.
Just outside of an elementary school.
Whoa, that's not a place you want to find a loose machete.
No. And, like, the machete had clearly seen some use.
It right. Was, on the elementary school?
Not that I'm aware of. But, like, the blade was a little bit chipped and it's got, like, some...
yeah, so
some
I just took home evidence.
So I just took home evidence of a horrifying child murder. but that's where I got my machete from. Right, and it's
right.
Not a thing that I have used for anything but camping,
but you have it.
I have it, and it's a more interesting story than I went to the knife store and bought one.
Yeah, I like this idea of going through like the kit that you have, and instead of like saying like, yes, I went and bought my pre-made kit from the adventures salesman, like, where did you get these different little things? How did you acquire them? You know, like you said, like, if you're a little junior adventurer, wet behind the ears, heading out for your first adventure, maybe you borrowed some stuff from some relatives. Like, oh, we put together a care package for you. Here's a rope and a backpack, and Grandpa made you some pemmican, you know?
Yeah. And I think my favorite one on here is the hooded lantern. And it's taken from your old apartment.
Yeah.
Right, so, like, shit that you have accumulated from various moves, where it's just like, this doesn't actually belong to me. This belongs to the place that I'm living, but fuck it, I'm taking it with me anyway.
Yeah, it belongs to me now. It was here when I got here, but it's not staying.
Yeah, so, and I definitely have some stuff. I have a bookshelf that is 100% just taken from the apartment that I was living in before I was in this one.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, things like that happen all the time.
Well, and then, like, looking at it from a fantasy standpoint, right?
Yeah.
I kind of came back to the Sardaukar for this, right? Their armor was bestowed upon them by Emperor Shaddam.
Right.
Right? Like, it's given to them for the purpose of protecting them in a variety of environments.
Right.
And the design reflects that.
Right.
Right? Like, it has, it's obviously environmental, right? It covers every part of their body. It is a sealed hermetic environment.
Uh-huh.
It is protective. It's got plates. It's also got, like, cloth across it that like, helps cover and helps deal with, like non-projectile type stuff.
Yeah.
Then yeah, the gear looks like the thing that it would do. And having been gifted to them from the Emperor, that has a very different weight to it for the character and for the world. Then I went to the armor shop and I bought some armor.
Right, right. Yeah, like, these guys have armor that is purpose-built for Deep Strike Elite Shock Troops. It's lightweight, but it's also, like, an icon of their service to the Emperor.
And it's practical in every environment, right? Like, you can have them fight in deep space.
Yeah.
You can have them fight in a horrifying poison swamp, because that is the purpose of this thing. So,
yeah, I mean, you even see in the movie, like, hey, the Harkonnens wear different outfits depending on where they're fighting these different people. The Sardaukar don't. They're just Sardaukar. Like, they're just all purpose murder machine.
We see them out of uniform, I think, twice. Like, out of combat uniform twice. And both times, they're still just wearing uniforms.
Yeah. Yeah, they took their hat off.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you're... I feel like if you're listening to our podcast, you probably know what a katana looks like.
Yeah, there's a non-zero chance you might own a katana.
And you probably know what a longsword looks like.
Yep.
And the difference between those two things mechanically is... zero.
Oh boy.
No, like, mechanically in D&D.
Oh, okay, way. Okay. Yeah. Sure.
Right.
I was going to say, you're about to start some fucking arguments.
I am not a, like, shadiversary. I am not the type of person who's going to get into, like, a detailed argument about types of swords and how they are different. But in, like, role-playing game terms...
Yeah.
There really isn't much of a difference between a longsword and a katana.
I will concede the point for the purposes of Dungeons & Dragons, but as the resident Shadiversity, like, representative here...
We can have that discussion at a different time, Josh.
I do want to state for the record, I'm not one of those dorks who's like, the katana is the perfect blade. It cannot be defeated in combat. I don't think like that at all, but I definitely know that there's a difference between your razor-sharp slicing weapon and your glorified metal club, so...
Okay. All right. I will concede the point, but they both do slashing damage.
Yes. Yes, they're both capable of slashing damage.
Yeah. But, like, as a visual,
yeah,
you have an idea about the type of person who is going to carry a katana.
Sure.
And there are a couple of different varieties of that. So you have your warrior in full kimono and hakama with a well-cared for katana that has been like lovingly crafted and taken care of by their family. It is a whole cultural thing.
Yeah.
And then you've got a teenager in a hoodie at the mall who has a cheap knockoff that he bought at the store that also sells like bongs.
Yeah. And then there's like the, you know, Western European mercenary who just like bought a sharpened piece of metal because he's like, I go through a couple of these a month.
Right. Yeah. And each of those is going to have a very different character, a very different flavor in how they carry their gear.
Yeah.
So, you know, looking at the hooded lantern from the above thing, like, is it tall and made of paper?
Yeah.
Is it like short and round? Does it have like a little oil spigot at the end? Like, what does this thing look like, and how does that actually inform us about who your character is,
mm-hmm.
and where they're from and where they got this stuff?
Yeah.
So,
is it glass fronted? Is it open top? Like, is it like,
yeah. Yeah, and like that doesn't necessarily have to have like a real world cultural connection. Like,
right.
I think there's actually like a stronger case to be made that if a katana exists in your fantasy world, it ain't going to be Japanese.
Right.
Right. Like, it's going to be a weapon that was created by a fantasy culture for fantasy culture reasons.
Right.
And will probably have some fundamental differences from the katana that exists in real life.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're I think you're doing a disservice to your world to be like, oh, every katana just steals Japanese stereotypes. Like,
but like, I think there's something to be said for like the, well, like Wheel of Time. Wheel of Time has a single bladed curved sword,
right,
that has a more European crossguard,
right,
but is in almost every other way a katana.
Yeah. And side note, I think they did a real disservice to the book by just making it a katana in the show.
Agreed. I think that like you want to have, did they have the crossguard in the show?
No, not that I saw. They went real lazy and just like had a katana for a guy, you know?
Weird. I'm not sure. I don't think I noticed that. Because I have like the compendium to the Wheel of Time book kicking around here, and I've definitely spent entirely too long going through and like looking at all the pictures and reading every entry.
Right.
And that sword didn't look the way that I was imagining it when I was reading the books.
Yeah.
And then I went and reread the books imagining that sword, and I was like, ah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So that, I feel like that would have stuck out to me. Huh. I guess, well, there was a lot of other stuff that wasn't matching up to
what
I was imagining in the books. Other than that Kyrian coat. Oh, man, that thing was gorgeous.
Sure.
There's like one coat that Rand wears in like one of the later episodes of season 2 that is just gorgeous.
Okay, I found a still from the show, and yeah, it's just a straight up katana.
No.
Yeah, I know. Just laziness.
Well, and like, this is like a whole other section that we're going to get into, but like, the importance of that sword,
yeah,
cannot be overstated.
Yeah,
like the first bunch of books, that sword is such a focal point for that character.
Yeah.
And for so many reasons, right? Like, it's a reminder of his father.
Yeah. Right?
It's something that he got from his father. It's a mystery, because where the fuck did Tam get this sword from?
Yeah.
It is a symbol that he hasn't earned.
Right.
It's a symbol of a sword master. He hasn't earned it. He hasn't learned the forms. It's also a symbol of a time before, right?
When, yeah.
Like, it's a... What was it Obi-Wan said?
Oh, a more elegant weapon from a more civilized time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was that. It's just a lightsaber.
Yeah. Just a lightsaber. Okay.
just a lightsaber katana, and the katana and the longsword are the same thing. Yeah, I got some hot takes today, bud.
I have a meltdown of my own fucking co-host. So for dorks who care about this kind of stuff, in the show, this Heron marked sword is literally just a katana with a heron on the habaki right above the tsuba, and that's it. Woo!
And, like, I think the thing that I was more concerned about with the sword was the lack of Rand's training with it.
Yeah.
Right, so, like, spoilers for season 2 of Wheel of Time.
If anyone's still watching that boring-ass show.
In the Wheel of Time books, in the first couple of books, Rand is being actively trained in the use of the Heron-marked blade by Lan, who is one of the strongest swordsmen in the world at the time of the books.
Yeah.
And he isn't getting trained at all in the show.
Right.
But, like, somehow magically knows Heron dips the wing when Lan goes to try and take his sword from him.
Yeah.
And, like, you can't...
Because it's instinctual.
You can't fucking tell me that Alvin Mandragoran wouldn't just, like, mop the fucking floor with that kid, regardless of what sword form he just busted out.
Yeah.
Right? Like, accidental sword form versus Lan?
Yeah.
The sword's in his hand. It's going to be in his hand.
Yeah.
Even after Rand was trained, it would be in his hands.
Yep.
But, yeah, so, like, the fact that they'd never actually spent any time training Rand how to use this fucking sword, and then didn't actually focus on the sword, and then the fucking finale fight where they didn't fight in the sky, it wasn't oh my god, and then the fight, the fucking sword, like, blade master fight right before that where Rand just, like, Indiana Joneses him with the one power instead of actually getting in a sword fight.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that episode. I'm having some flashbacks.
Anyways, some missteps in the series, we'll say.
Yeah. Oh god. No, I...
Okay. Let's stop talking about swords for a second. Let's get back to talking about armor.
Okay, yeah, armor.
So, you wanted to touch on... Because armor, you know, it's commonplace in fantasy settings, but also this can apply to your... you know, obviously we've been talking about a sci-fi series that still has armor and reasons for having armor, but even in a series without that, there can be quote-unquote armor that helps set character, right? They specifically brought up Vader as an example of this, that sells a couple of different ideas on the character itself.
Vader is such a brilliant fucking design.
Yeah.
Like, selling the samurai look, for one thing, in, like, a sci-fi, like, that had the chance to be so cheesy.
Right.
Like, if done incorrectly, it would have just been hilariously bad.
Yeah.
But he is menacing and powerful, and you feel it right away. And I think the fact that, like, the guy that they had playing him is, like, 6'11" or something.
It helps. It helps to have him just be physically imposing.
Yeah, but, like, the shape of the helmet, right? Like, if you just look at the silhouette of Darth Vader, he kind of looks like a dick.
Yeah.
But the shape of the helmet has, like, a vague skull shape to it, right? Like,
oh, 100%, yeah.
The eyes, the teeth in the front with the respirator, right? So it's got, like, some of the Nazi aesthetic that they're trying to push for the Emperor.
There's a very specific what is it called? Totenkopf that the Nazis use all the time as part of their imagery that they're definitely pulling on for Vader there. But I think in addition to Nazi stuff, they were also trying to pull from, like, they wanted to pull some of the elements from the samurai history. So, like, the idea of, they wanted to initially they sell the idea that, like, Jedi and Sith wind up in duels, and like the samurai duel is a classic image from the samurai movies that inspired Lucas in the first place.
I mean, he was a huge Kurosawa fan.
Yeah. So, and then pulling on the themes of that sort of Bushido code and stuff like that that were present in the Jedi. Just helps tie that into Vader being a fallen Jedi, right? Like,
yeah.
There was a system of honor that he came from that he's now sort of turned his back on, but it's still part of his character and manifests later when he turns on his master, right?
Well, and it also manages to evoke Arthurian themes. Like the Black Knight and Mordred. Standing in the way of the young hero,
right,
from getting to Camelot and saving the day, right? Like it's so brilliant how many things they were able to tie together just with the look of the armor that they were building for that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few other really good examples of like well designed armor. Game of Thrones. Armor from the Game of Thrones, right? Like the Hound's armor.
Yes.
Where like the guy's faceplate is purposefully like hideous and hard to look at.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's he's big and he's ugly, and so is his armor. And like the smaller, sleeker armor, fucking Joffrey's armor, which is all like inlaid with gold and clearly useless.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know the way that the Dothraki dress compared to the people of Westeros, right? And the like other armies that I can never remember her real name. Dany?
Oh, Daenerys.
Yeah, that she's like slowly beginning to pull in towards herself. So like I don't know how important that's gonna be in the books, assuming that George ever finishes them. But like Westerosi knights are encased in chunks of metal.
Yeah.
While all of Daenerys' warriors are butt naked.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
Like, well, it's her Unsullied aren't wearing armor. The Dothraki aren't wearing armor.
Are they not wearing armor in the books?
I think they're wearing, like, leathers.
Yeah, because they have, like, basic leather stuff in the show. So, yeah, it's light, high-mobility armor versus, like, tanks, right?
Which has always done so well against it, cavalry.
Yeah, yeah. But I think like something that they were trying to pull on as well was like the classic like berserkers versus Roman Empire kind of underdog fight, where like these are people who fight with speed and passion versus like strict military discipline and conscription and war as a job rather than war as like a way of life, you know?
How often do you think about the Roman Empire?
it's weekly. I'm not gonna lie. It's oh, I have not had a week go by where I haven't thought about the Roman Empire.
It's kind of an old meme now.
It has staying power because it's just true. It's just facts.
Yeah. Especially if the man that you were talking to is at all a nerd. it's going to be there for a while. Yeah. So, like, other types of armor that are very cool. Game of Thrones has it. Wheel of Time does not.
Yeah. So, I guess the thrust of what we're saying, though, is that, like, you need to be considering what your equipment, even the basic stuff, looks like on you. Like, it's one thing to say, I have studded leather, but, like, what does studded leather look like? And why would you be wearing studded leather? Or why would you be wearing leather, like, that kind of studded leather? Because it's very easy to fall into the trap of, like, I am Paladin. I take biggest, heaviest armor. off I go to smite people for Jesus, right? Like, it's it's basic to just be like, yep, I'm wearing scale, and when they let me, I'm going to buy plate. But, like, as an example, so that sorcerer I'm playing?
Yeah.
He's in plate armor.
Oh.
On paper. But, obviously, that doesn't really... So, I'm going to sidetrack for a second just to give you the, like, character concept. He is a retired old Jewish jewelry maker whose wife got sick of him being around the house all day. When the Frost Maiden showed up and like everything turned cold forever, his forge went out, or his crucible is like useless. So he's like, well, I guess I'll just retire. And after a couple years of that, his life was like, get the fuck out of the house. But he is a he is a like devout Hasidic Jew, and his powers, he doesn't think he has powers. What he thinks is happening is that God is just answering his prayers and intervening on his behalf.
So when did Judaism get to the Forgotten Realms? Well, that seems like a...
That's unimportant. Yahweh is everywhere.
Have you listened to any Dungeons and Daddies?
No.
It's a podcast where like four dudes are taking their kids to a soccer camp.
Okay.
And drive their van into the Forgotten Realms by accident.
Okay.
And as they are recovering from the car accident, they wake up and find out that their kids have been sold into slavery.
Oh, okay.
And so they go on a magical quest through the Forgotten Realms to find their kids.
Okay, fair.
But one of the characters is a devout Catholic.
Oh, okay. So he's having some trouble with his polytheism out there.
A little bit. And like there's one point where they're dealing with some vampires. And one of the characters is an ordained minister in one of those bullshit religions that lets you marry people.
Yeah.
It's not actually a religion. It's just there so that you can get your papers.
It's legally a religion, but that's it.
Yeah. And so that character is like, well, maybe I can like bless the holy water and like bless the water in the windshield wipers to attack this vampire.
Yeah.
The Catholic guy is like, how about you don't make fun of my religion, you douche?
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe something similar happened way back in the past.
Exactly.
Your campaign. There's just like two Jewish guys came over and,
Two rabbis were trying families. To dig another tunnel under New York City to get to their church services, and accidentally dug all the way to the Forgotten Realms.
Fantastic.
Anyways, so
I thought we were going to get canceled when I was talking about like katanas versus long swords.
Nope, it's the Hasidic Jews in the Forgotten Realms. A New York Jew goes to Baldur's Gate. That's anyway.
It's been fun, folks.
So he's on paper. I took the ability for him to wear plate because he I took one level of cleric as well, which is where this whole build starts off with, and he's divine soul sorcerer. You know, he's got one level of cleric due to his like. What do we call it? Synagogue training as a child. But so mechanically, it's just plate mail, and he's slower because he's wearing plate because he has strength 8.
okay.
But the way thematically that plays out in the game is that he's just an old man who's kind of slow, but every time something tries to hit him, like God is literally protecting him, right?
I want to make it really clear that Josh is not Jewish.
I'm kind of the opposite of a Jew.
Like, I don't know what that means, and I really don't want you to unpack it. No, the mic's hot.
I'm just saying, since we're talking about Nazis, I'm like tall, blonde, blue eyed. Very much nothing but Caucasian background. So, you know, the opposite.
Oh my god. I don't know how we got here.
Anyway,
armor.
Abraham Goldbergstein is protected by his god instead of instead of a giant piece of metal that he's dragging around across the countryside. Mechanically, right. It works the same, but I thought about, like, what does this actually look like in game? And Right. Yeah.
Well, I'm like, yeah, I think that's an important piece of it, is that you're the equipment that's on the piece of paper doesn't have to look like the equipment in real life,
right? Or the equipment in the book.
Or the equipment in the book. Like, you can wear studded leather that is just a greaser outfit.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's a studded leather jacket and some blue jeans and a white t-shirt.
Yeah.
Or you can wear studded leather armor that is just a gimp suit with studs on it, right? Like, there's a lot of variety in what a studded leather outfit is going to look like.
Yeah.
And how you choose to do that is going to say a lot about your character and where that character is from and the connections that that character has to the rest of the adventure world.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, if you're a mage who's just wearing cloth, like, you don't have to have big flowy robes all the time. You could just be a kid in a tracksuit, you know?
I remember reading one of the extended universe Dragonlance books when I was a kid, and one of the things about that book that kind of blew my mind was one of the mages in the Mage's Towers was dressed like a pirate.
Okay.
Right, like he had a big open flowy shirt and some tight breeches and a big hat, and he looked like a pirate.
Yeah.
And I had never considered reading a D&D inspired book that's what a wizard could look like.
Yeah. Like, you read the description, you're like, where's his sword? I'm supposed to swashbuckle. And he's like, fireball. And you're like, oh no! This is a terrible duel.
The worst kind of duel. My ship is on fire and we're sinking.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about magic items for a minute.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I really wanted to talk about magic items because this is something that I feel has been a pretty radical change. And I hate to talk about it again, but 4th edition tried something really wild with magic items that they've been
further than that.
Okay, yeah. They scaled it back in 5, but yeah, let's talk about magic items as character device and storytelling.
Right. So one of the things that, like, one of the reasons I want to go back to 3rd is because 3rd edition had really interesting and robust rules for magic item creation. Right, you had the ability to just build a magic item as a player character.
Right.
And it had all of the tools that you needed for calculating out the gold cost and the specific components that you would need. And then also, like, the part where it kind of fell apart was the experience point cost.
Right.
Was like anytime you have to spend experience points in order to get
that's bad
item, not bad, just counterintuitive, right? Like,
I'll say it's I don't feel good about it.
It feels like punishment.
Yeah, right?
Like, it feels like you're putting your own progress on hold for the sake of a magic item that may or may not even be for you.
Right.
But, like, there are some really fantastic homebrewed magic items out there.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we are unable to recreate those without, like, DM fiat being the reason.
Yeah.
Kind of hurts my feelings.
Yeah, like, I was really disappointed with how little actual, like, never mind magic, but just crafting in general, how little was in 5th edition as, like,
there's none.
Yeah, like, it's like, oh, I want to get, like, I remember reading 3 and 3.5 books where they're like, yeah, you can use, you know, let's say splint mail, but also here's like 6 subtypes of splint mail that you can go make. And maybe your splint mail is made out of wood and it has these like cool natural properties that like entangle weapons when they're attacking you and things like that. Like, I was looking forward to being able to make that kind of stuff. And then it's just, there's nothing. It's just like, oh, you made plate. There you go.
Well, and like the role of magic weapons in fifth edition. Like the role of magic items in general,
yeah,
fifth edition feels like it's changed.
Yeah, they're very stingy with them.
Yeah, like 3.5 had the ability to create magic items, which was like built into part of the balance of the game.
Yeah.
And that's what I think the experience point cost was meant to create, was like a cost to the balance of your character in order to be able to have this other thing.
Right.
In fourth edition, they were expected, which was something that a lot of people kind of rebelled against. You were expected to have a certain level of magic gear at certain levels in fourth edition.
Yeah, I mean, in fourth edition, it was not just expected, but like required that your character was getting a certain amount of gear as you progressed, to the point where, like, when they published Dark Sun in a low magic setting, they had to create alternative rules for boons that would that would compensate for the lack of magic weapons, because like, yeah, you need to have those pluses, otherwise, like, you can't do your basic function.
And, like, I kind of get why some people fought against that, because, like, the magic item lottery is sort of a weird one to play, and, like, if your DM is kind of stingy with the magic items, then you're going to be behind in your progression, and it's going to make encounters more difficult.
Yep.
Whereas if they are too generous with them, then suddenly every encounter becomes a breeze, right? So, like, it created a very interesting dynamic where the DM's generosity with this resource was going to change the course of your game.
Yeah.
And then in fifth edition, I don't have our characters are like fourth, fifth level right now, and nobody has a magic weapon.
Yeah. We are sixth level. I think I have one.
Right. And like, we have some magic items, but they're magic items that I have done a lot of like the world building work.
Yeah.
Right. So like we've got our MacGuffin
as
a magic item. We've got like a couple of things. Eberron is kind of interesting in role playing game stuff, just because like magic is so pervasive in Eberron. You walk into a corner store and you can buy magic trinkets.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, mage rites are everywhere, making like a broom that has a low-level enchantment for Unseen Servant.
Yeah.
Right. It's just a Roomba. Right? so we have, like, a couple of those low-level trinkets. Because we're in Sharn, one of the ones that they introduced in the 3.5 Sharn handbook was a Talisman of Featherfall.
Okay, yeah.
You can only use it once. You have to make, like, a dex save to make sure that you timed it right.
Yeah.
But it can save your life if you fall off a bridge.
Yeah.
Right, you're in a city that grows up. So yeah, you're going to have like some random magic doodads that are going to save you from that shit. So we've got a couple of those things, right? Like we've got potions, we've got one-off items, we have the MacGuffin, and that's it.
Yep. Yeah.
They found a potion because I rolled on a random treasure table.
Yeah, and I think our game has started to like add in more random treasure rolls, because it's just like, God, we have nothing.
It's actually kind of interesting to me how little looting has happened in my games.
Really?
Yeah, like, I am fairly familiar with the murder hobo trend of, like, stab a monster, take it stuff.
Right.
My players roll real bad on the regular, and frequently forget or don't have time to loot the bodies.
Yeah.
This is one of the first times in a very long time where, like, everything around them that was a threat was actually dead.
Yeah.
And so they actually had a chance to, like, dig through somebody's pockets and, like, come up with some gold in the potion.
Yeah.
But yeah, other than that, like, every other encounter that they've been in, they've been, like, forced to run away, they've, like, killed a couple of people, and then, like, reinforcements have arrived because they failed some rolls. Yeah, there's been a dearth of looting.
Well, and what's funny is, like, we we have not done a lot of like looting in our group, but it's more been because like there's just nothing to loot. Like, it's like, what are you going to get off of a random cave troll? Like, his underwear? Cool. You know, we're
shouldn't
not...
Shouldn't a random cave troll have a cave troll horde, though?
Apparently not. We found his wife and kid and, just stuff. Like, nothing useful. I think one time we... Oh, you know what? One time we did find a magic cauldron for making food.
Oh, good.
Yeah. We have an infinite supply of soup.
I mean, if you're going to have an infinite supply of something, soup seems like a pretty good one.
I think part of it, too, is that, like, the adventuring that happens for this campaign is outdoors, like, a lot.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, there's not, like, well-established towns that have a lot of stuff. It's pretty remote, so it makes sense we're not finding, like, crazy stuff, but we did run into some mind flayers who gave us a laser gun.
Oh, that seems good.
Yeah. I lost it when I died.
The dragon ate your laser gun.
Yeah.
Everyone is anyways. Dark Sun is also neat, because like Dark Sun, the assumption is just that you don't have any magic items.
Yeah.
Right. And that's true across editions as well.
Yeah. You just, the way they handled it for 4th edition was you get blessings, so that you get the plus ones and plus twos that you need to survive.
Right. And like, looking at things like Arturian Legends.
Yeah.
Right? Like all of the Arturian Legends are built around a couple of key magic items.
Yeah.
Right? You've got Excalibur, you've got the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's others that I'm forgetting in the moment. But like Excalibur and the Holy Grail in particular are like the key focus of a lot of the Arturian legends.
Yeah.
Nobody else really has a magic sword.
Oh.
Or if they do, it's like the focus of one story.
Yeah.
Right. Gawain and the Green Axe, right? That is just a whole story that takes like 2 years. And I don't remember if he gets to keep the axe or not.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm no Arthurian, you know, scholar.
I'm not as much as I would like to be. I have read a lot of the newer books, but like The Once and Future King is not Le Mort d'Arthur.
Yeah.
So like the version that I have gotten is focused a little differently than scholarly. But
yeah.
But like I think that like having a few magic items of note makes those magic items cooler than having a whole bunch of them just always.
Gotcha, yeah.
Right. Like having a whole lot of plus three swords makes every plus three sword kind of baseline now.
Yeah. If they're popping out of every random guard scabbard as you murder your way across the highway. Yeah.
Well, and like I think that's part of what makes Eberron interesting is that like there are plus three swords just everywhere. Right? Like all of the King's Guards are gonna have a plus three sword.
Yeah.
Right? The plus one swords, every cop in Sharn has a plus one sword.
Yeah.
But then you find like the really weird stuff. Right, like the stuff that you get from like Darkest Zendrick or like from the ruins of ancient civilizations or from like the middle of the horrifying wasteland that it used to be Syrie.
Yeah. Right?
Like those are things that you can build campaigns around, and then because they're so much more powerful, they seem cooler.
Yeah.
The MacGuffin in my game is a weapon of mass destruction. Right? Like it's a crystallized bit of evil that causes body horror to happen around it.
Right.
It like slowly converts people into demons that like slither out of their own skin.
That's horrifying. Which is,
yeah, right. And it was gross and it was a lot of fun to play. In our last session, as they were trying to get this thing, like the magic starts as soon as a priest attunes to the item.
Right.
And a priest had just started attuning to this item. And so my players were making constitution saves against this change. And I got to describe like the like weird spikes and things that were like prodding them from the inside.
Ew, fun.
Whenever they like fail to save. And one of my player characters almost turned into one of these horrifying demons.
Okay.
She failed two saves in a row. If she'd failed a third, that was like, you're a demon now. Or if you rolled like a natural one. But like getting that away from the priest turns it into a normal thing until somebody else starts attuning with it. And
right.
That means that now they're holding a like literal weapon of mass destruction in the middle of the most populous city in the world.
That sounds handy.
Right? They have a nuke in New York. What do?
Nuke York.
But, like, some systems, you can play around with, like, the levels of magic items to make them cool. Like, MacGuffins, obviously, they're going to have, like, specific effects.
Yeah.
Working with.
Yeah.
But, like, 4E, everybody's got to have magic items.
Right.
Fifth edition, I don't actually know how that works. Like a plus one sword gets a lot more important when you have the action economy behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how much that balancing gets fucked up by like having a lot of those weapons kicking around.
Well, honestly, like I don't think we've gotten far enough in to really see the effects of it yet. So
yeah, that's fair. And then like the last thing that I kind of wanted to talk about was like, gear that is cool as a storytelling item.
Okay, yeah.
That can or doesn't have to be magic.
Right.
Right. We already talked a little bit about Rand's Heron Marked Blade from Wheel of Time. There's actually a bunch of items in that series that I think are interesting storytelling and character pieces.
Okay.
Matt Cawthon has a like spear and a big floppy hat and a scarf that he wears.
Right.
That are like a reminder of a trial that he got through.
Mm-hmm.
Perrin always carries both an axe and a hammer.
Yeah.
And Perrin Ibarra is my favorite character in the series. And like the duality between creation and destruction with his character is like what really drew me to him. And that's really reflected in his obvious and constant discussion of these two items.
Right, right.
Like I can recognize that he's a little annoying when he's just sitting there with like, those two items in his hands, like crying about having to take lives. which is like every third chapter.
Like, yeah, sad boy time.
It's an interesting external reflection of what that character is going through.
Right? Yeah.
And what tool he is using in which moment gives you clues to what he's thinking, even when you're not in his point of view.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Hanzo blade from Kill Bill.
Yeah. Like the multiple characters reference the significance of the fact that like the bride is able to go and get this like very specific weapon that has a lot of like meaning and intent behind it, but also just like communicates the level of effort and like resolve that she has in order to like do this prep work before going on her, you know, world revenge tour.
And you also mentioned Blue-Eyed Samurai. I haven't seen the series.
Yeah, there's some stuff that's brought up because like the character starts their history as like an orphan working for a bladesmith who like doesn't know that they're, well, okay, spoilers, they don't know that they're a girl. Otherwise they would never have allowed the samurai to work for them. And then when she goes to go on her revenge tour, again, takes a sword from him that like marks her as, the quality of the sword and like its pedigree mark her out as like she shouldn't have this, you know, like she's because the whole series struggles with like the outsiderism of the character. You know, she is a woman with a sword, shouldn't be In this ultra racist version of Japan, she's like mixed race. She shouldn't be, you know, things like that. They use a lot of like that. It helps embody some of the themes that they're going for in the show in general. But it's an important, like, swords become an important storytelling tool in the series. You know, the brutal nature of one guy and the sword that he had made for him are matched up, you know? And they're not magical. They're just swords. But, like, yeah. What is a guy who's too angry and impatient to wait for a good sword? What does that sword wind up looking like, you know? And why does it work for him?
Well, that kind of, like, the difference in the style of the blades between the Uruk-hai and the elves in Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Right? Like that's kind of what you get with that, too, where it's just like the elves are putting in all this time to make this absolutely masterful, beautiful piece of art that is also meant for stabbing things. And the orcs have made meat cleavers with hooks on them.
Well, and even like, so like the elves, and again, I'm just basing this on the movies, but theirs are designed to be used in like formation and concert with other people. And the blade is designed around the trained swing that they have to work in unison. And like the Uruk-hai swords are mass-produced blunt instruments with a spike on the end, you know, that they put a little bit of time into sharpening up, but really it is like just angular, might as well be stamped iron.
Yeah, and I think like there's some imagery that would suggest that it is.
Yeah, right?
Like, and then yeah, I think like the elephant in the room when it comes to like fantasy gear, the One Ring,
right,
like. The thing that you build an entire campaign around, right? Like that one piece of gear that is important enough to both the like main characters and the antagonists that everybody is literally fighting to get it.
And similar to what you're saying about like Arthurian legend and stuff like that, like you're talking about equipment that's evocative and important, but again, only one piece in like the entire series is actually magical.
Well, there were a bunch of others.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's like rake blades and stuff like that. But I'm saying, like, when you're talking about like that group, like, there's really only one magic item that really matters, you know?
Yeah, and it like ties together the other magic items that are going around, like all of the other rings that are out there. But yeah, and that kind of has its own push behind it.
Yeah.
The adventure hooks in the One Ring are kind of already there. Or at least they were after Tolkien went back and edited Riddles in the Dark.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, went back and like remade it so that the One Ring was way more important in The Hobbit. But yeah, I don't know. I think items and armor and weapons and things can be a lot more important than we often let them be. Because they can serve as like really great reminders of difficult times that you've had in the past or great times that you've had in the past and like character moments. Or they can be symbols.
I think the thrust we're trying to get at here is like items don't have to be magical to make them special and impactful. Just be a lot more like cognizant of like things that you own.
But if they are magical and also special, that's cool too.
Oh yeah, no, I'm not saying you don't need magic items. I'm just saying like don't be afraid to make mundane items special for some reason, and encourage your players to, and this will help with immersion, is just be more aware of like the little things that, like, I know last week we railed a little bit about like tediousness and minutia, but there's some minutia that just adds depth, that's, you know, grounding for people.
What I would want to suggest as like a challenge, and like maybe like throw this in the comments if you've actually done it, I would love to see a campaign where like magic items exist, but the big item, like the item that you build your entire campaign around is actually mundane. Right, like something that isn't magical is the most important item in this magical world. I would love to see that.
Yeah, there's like a sub, you know, sub quest, little side task thing for my character where like I'm trying to retrieve my father's ring. Is it magic? Nope, it's just my dad's. You know?
I mean, you could go easy with it too, where it's just like we're going for the crown.
Sure.
Like the crown doesn't have any magic on it, but it's obviously a big important symbol for stuff. But I would love to see like your story about your ring, right? Like build the entire campaign around something like that. And I think it could be a really great story.
Definitely.
Hey, thanks for making it all the way through this episode of No Plot Only Lore. If you're looking for more, you can always find us at noplotonlylore.com and on all the very best podcast platforms. If you like what you heard today, please share, rate, and review the show to feed my never-ending need for attention and validation.